Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is Thursday, May the 1st, 2025, and this is episode 3664 of the Survival Podcast. It is Thursday, that means it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week, and may I just say, for me anyway, this week has flown. I felt a little bit off coming back from being on the road. It always does that. And then we have a schedule here that you guys really don't see, but it involves when the kids are here and when they're not. They're usually here Monday, and they weren't. So with all of that, like, it just felt like an off week. But I feel like we've had a fire week of shows. That we've done some really good work this week, maybe one of the better weeks as a whole in a long time. You know, we led off on Monday with one of the most well-attended live streams for a Bitcoin-centric show I've ever had about why 21 Capital changes everything. That's one of the more forward-looking shows I've ever done on economics. Even though it's Bitcoin-centric, it is a reality that this is about to change everything, and you have a front-run opportunity. Then we moved on and did an Edible Ops Behind the Lines show on Tuesday. That was 3662, and we talked about how to plant all kinds of cool stuff that you can eat that defeats the Karens, even in right in the middle of an HOA. And then I got Olga on yesterday, who from Mushroom Mountain. That was a fantastic interview. I cannot wait to get her back on to talk about more of the medicinal properties and things like that. And that was kind of the coming out party. I'd already announced it a week earlier, but not with true fanfare, that we now have a discount at Mushroom Mountain of 15%. And I said during my episode yesterday, I'm going to order one of them oyster kits. I lied. I didn't order one. I ordered two. I ordered a blue one and a pink one. And then I used that new discount code. It saved me $9. A membership's $50. One order saved me $9 on one thing. And I'll be ordering more from there. Here's what I'm going to tell you about MSB, guys. No lie. I save more money every year than 3 to 4 times the cost of an MSB membership using my own membership discounts. I really do. Now, I do buy quite a bit from Rand over at Akira Botanicals. That's high-dollar stuff with a really steep discount, so that helps. But, I mean, I get discounts on coffee. I get discounts on plants. I get discounts on all the stuff you guys get discounts on. So if you're not yet an MSB member, consider becoming one. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more about that. And remember, if you are military, this is all prior service or active duty. Doesn't matter. Don't have to be retired. Just prior service or active duty. Military, law enforcement, first responder like paramedics, EMTs, etc., or a member of the Peace Corps. All of those qualify what we call a service discount. If you want that discount before you join, not after, email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. Put TSPC in the subject line, and then tell me about your service, and I'll send you the information on the discount. It's pretty damn good, and it applies to all the memberships, and it applies to recurring. Everybody else is $50 a month. If you've never considered becoming a member, please check it out. I know that everybody that has a podcast has some sort of membership or whatever. I really went out of my way when I put MSB together years ago, and it's the main way we pay the bills around here, to make sure if you bought it, if you used it, that it paid you more than you paid for it. And so there's really no reason not to be a member. If you decided you hated me, it's still a good deal. Anyway, with that, what are we going to talk about today? I got a great lineup for you. I'm kind of excited. I hadn't heard from Chris Rossini with Ron Paul this week, but I think he's on vacation is why. But Chef Ken Daniels will be our leadoff today. He's going to talk about poaching quail eggs. That way you can eat like royalty. Quail and quail's eggs were always considered the meal of kings, by the way. Matt Seriously will talk about how to make the problem a solution. You got kids that are expensive. You got work needs doing. You probably give your kids an allowance. What if their allowance was a little bit better, but they did a whole bunch of work for you and they got a paycheck? Then you got to deduct your kid's allowance, and then they didn't pay any taxes on it because they don't make enough money to pay any taxes. You can do all that if you have a home-based business. Matt Seriously or actually if you have a business at all, Matt Sersley can talk to you about that today. Ryan Steva, the homestead consultant, will answer a question on rehabbing some jerry cans that have seen better days. Nicholas Ferguson will talk about tractoring chickens on a gravel driveway for weed control. And I have an add-on, a concern about doing that. It's not a bad thing, but you may not be fully thinking it through when you do it. And I'll just have an observation about gravel. Just an interesting observation about gravel. Then you also, we have a segment from Dr. Bones on prevention and treating of Giardia, which is a very important topic. And water availability and diarrhea are some of the biggest concerns in disaster zones. When the Haitian earthquake hit more than a decade ago, more people died of things like that than from the earthquake itself. And last, I have a segment today on what I'm calling the trade deal domino theory. Now, when you were in school, especially if you're older like me, and you were in history class, at some point you studied the Vietnam conflict. And you probably learned about domino theory, which was if we didn't go shed blood and treasure in Vietnam, and Vietnam went communist, the whole of the East would go communist, right? It would be like a domino giant, which was a bullshit way to lie us into war. But the trade war domino theory was about to happen in real time and really, really fast. And it's going to turn everything around economically for the U.S., at least short term. How long it's sustainable, I don't know. But everything's, it's going to be a big, giant dam of dominoes breaking loose. Now, it's interesting how my segment came to be today. At least I think it's interesting, right? I ran an X poll today. Don't do a lot of those, except for the ones I'm doing right now on music, which if you follow me on X, you probably know. If you don't, you don't. But it's just a fun thing we're doing with music. But I don't do a lot of X polls. But once in a while when I'm like, well, I got different things I could talk about today, what would that, you know, what should it be? Well, I had three today. I was going to do a segment on what's called over-the-counter Bitcoin trading and how you can have these companies like StrategyB, MicroStrategy, what have you, you know, buying tens of thousands of Bitcoins, billions of dollars in Bitcoin on a single day and not having a huge response to the price. Over-the-counter is one of the things that mitigates that immediate price response. And so I thought I might do that. The trade deal dominoes that we're going to cover, or why the rare earth deal in Ukraine signals an end to the war. It was fairly competitive, but not. So the over-the-counter Bitcoin and rare earth deal both got about 20 to 25% of the vote. 53% of the vote went to the trade deal domino segment. Now, I actually wanted to talk about the over-the-counter Bitcoin thing, but if I'm going to run the poll and I'm going to ask you guys what you want and there's a clear victor and I don't do it, then I'm just kind of jerking you around. So we'll do the trade deal dominoes. We'll definitely talk about the other two as segments in some shows, maybe some variety shows next week. But that's another reason to follow me on X, right? If you do that, you can participate with things like that. You might find out what this music thing is I'm talking about. I'll spill the beans, but it's almost over. It's almost over. I got one more round. We're doing 12 rounds, and we're looking for the best 80s rock ballads for now. There might be another thing coming. And they might play off each other, and they might have a showdown. We're running 12 rounds, four songs each, and we're up to round 11 as of right now, which means it'll be next week we will start the semifinals. Where instead of going four songs to a poll, we'll have 12, and we'll do six rounds of head-to-head. That'll give us three. Top performer gets a bye, and then the next two go head-to-head, and then the bye and the winner of those two compete for the champion. And there will be some YouTube playlists created out of this and stuff like that. It has nothing to do with preparedness. It's just fun. And I've actually gotten a ton of comments from people on X about thank you for doing something that's not all wrapped up in the world and just fun. And for those of us in our 40s, 50s, 60s, some pretty cool nostalgia as well. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and hear from our first expert today, Chef Ken Daniels on poaching quail's eggs. I can't believe I've never done this because I've eaten a lot of quail's eggs.
Hello everyone, Chef Ken here. Today we're tackling a question from Linda. How the hell do you poach quail eggs? And better yet, how do you poach a bunch of them without losing your mind? Listen, I love quail eggs. They're little flavor bombs, more yolk than white, elegant, punchy. They look amazing on a plate, but they are small. And if you treat them like full-size chicken eggs, you're going to blink and they're overcooked real quick or just become a mess. So today I'm going to walk you through two ways to do it. One of my personal favorites is the sous vide. It's clean, predictable, holds beautifully, and gives you some breathing room with time. The second method is a little more traditional. It's the stovetop method. Faster, sure, but a little more chef under fire energy. It still works, and I'll tell you how to make it smooth. So today I'm going to give you my exact method, the one I use in my own kitchen when I want quail eggs to look and taste perfect. Whether I'm doing stovetop or sous vide, I start with one key technique that changes everything. Let's start with the big idea first. Quail eggs poach beautifully if you give them the right setup. And that setup for me always starts with a trick called pre-setting the whites. Quail eggs, like duck eggs, have a looser white. That means the second they hit the hot water, that thin albumin wants to go rogue. You get these wisp trails, these like jellyfish-like tentacles that float through the water. And here's how we fix that. I use what I call the preset method. It's simple, gentle, and it gives you control before the heat ever hits. I fill a small bowl with cold water, add a splash of acid like white vinegar, lemon juice, or white wine if you're feeling fancy, and I rest a fine mesh strainer right in that bowl. I crack the quail eggs into that strainer, and I let them sit in that acidic water bath for about 3 to 5 minutes, and that's it. The acid will start to lightly set the outer layer of the white, not cooking it, not pickling it, just giving it a little bit of a backbone. You'll start to notice it turns a bit white and look like it has a little bit more of that traditional poached egg look. The process kind of structures the egg whites around the yolk so it's less likely to break apart the second it hits the heat. Okay, from here, you've got two paths, stovetop or sous vide. So let's go to the stovetop first. If you're doing a smaller batch, maybe 3 or 4 eggs at a time, stovetop is fast, clean, and totally doable. Bring a pot of water to just below a simmer. Look, you're looking for calm water, no bubbles breaking the surface. Something like a gentle spa for your eggs, not power jets. Add a splash of vinegar or lemon juice, again, just enough to help the white set up. Then take that same strainer of preset eggs directly out of the preset water and gently lowered into the hot water all at once. Don't drop them in one by one. Keep it tight. You want them in, settled, and undisturbed. This transfer of all the eggs in the strainer is quick and painless. Let them poach for 45 to 60 seconds tops. That's all it takes for quail egg. The whites will firm up. The yolks stay soft and golden. And if you're careful, those eggs will still be easy enough to lift out all together in that same strainer. This is a great method when you just need a few. But if you need 10, 15, 24, 48, that's where the sous vide comes in. Sous vide isn't just about cooking meat. It's seriously one of the best ways to poach delicate things like quail eggs without rushing or messing up your timing. Set your water bath to about 167 degrees Fahrenheit or about 75 degrees Celsius. Fill it with enough water to comfortably hold a secondary vessel, something like a large wide mouth mason jar or even another stock pot. You want this vessel to sit fully submerged in the water bath, but still easy to access. In that secondary container, add water and your acid of choice. Same ratio as before, a teaspoon of vinegar or lemon juice per cup of water. Let that vessel sit in the water bath for a few minutes so it warms up to match a sous vide temperature. Then, and only then, transfer your preset quail eggs from the strainer into that container. You're poaching them in place under gentle circulating heat with no turbulence. Set a timer for 8 minutes. That's your sweet spot. The whites will be set, the yolks still glossy and runny, but if you want something firmer, push it to 10 minutes. If you're not ready to serve right away, pull the eggs and place in an ice bath. Now, if you're a chef nerd like me, I've got two sous vides. I set another one for around 125 to 130 degrees Fahrenheit. And if I know I've got a big party and I know I'll need a bunch of eggs, I'll poach it 167 degrees, ice bath, and then throw back in the other sous vide set at 130. This will give me about 30 to 45 minutes of breathing room to finish cooking other things, and the eggs will stay of the perfect consistency. So sous vide can seem more involved, but if you've got a ton of eggs to poach, there's no better way. So there you go. Poaching quail eggs doesn't have to be a nightmare. It just needs a plan. Start with the preset method every time, no shortcuts. Then choose your lane. Stovetop if you're cooking a few, sous vide if you need volume and control. Big pro tip, grab a quail egg cutter. Quail eggs can be a pain in the ass to crack and not make a mess. I actually think Jack has some on T-Spaz. This is a must if you own or have quail eggs. Know your egg math as well. I typically go about 4 quail eggs roughly equals 1 chicken egg. So that's kind of my ratio. And most importantly, just don't panic. Look, these things can look small and delicate, but once you've got a method, it's super easy. Don't forget to check out all of my growing recipes and my journey as a diabetic chef at bloodsugarchef.com. Keep those questions coming in. Until next time, this is Ken, the Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
So a couple thoughts on this. One, it would be a really cool play on a Benedict. You could do anything from like little bites of English muffin and do it traditional with some hollandaise and stuff like that. But where I think this would be really cool is to make some medallion-sized sausage. Just good old-fashioned breakfast sausage, a quail egg on top of it, and a hollandaise drizzle on that. And then you're pretty much carnivore, definitely keto. And there are other things you could do to put something under it, and then just play with that. There's a bunch of ways to do that. And they are also like little flavor bites. He's right. So, like, those would be good on a salad. Those would be good if you were doing something with ground beef where you're not, you know, you're a carnivore and you're cutting up like basically a hamburger steak with that would be fantastic. Just another way to use this thing that so many of you in the audience are growing already. Quail are one of probably the number three most popular livestock in the audience. I'd say number one's chickens, number two's ducks, number three's quail, number four's rabbit. And it could be some jockeying for position in there, but I would say those four are your top four among the audience. So a lot of you doing it anyway. But one thing he didn't mention is quail egg scissors. And the only reason I bring it up, I thought everybody knew this, but I keep watching these cooking shows and these supposed 4-star Michelin chefs and shit are out there trying to crack a quail egg on the side of a dish. It is dumb. It is stupid. A quail egg pair of scissors costs you about $2. I have a link where you can get a set of two for like $7. They're a little bit better ones, but they're all just fine. This is not a high-end tool to begin with. We used to buy them in packages of 30, and that got us the price down to about $2 a set. Sometimes we could get them for even less. When we had a more commercial-level egg business and we were doing quail and duck eggs, the first time we would ever sell quail eggs to somebody or even like a really good customer, maybe give them a package, we would always give them a set of shears and tell them how to use them. Because without them, you're like, this is just too much of a pain in the ass. With them, you're like, this is easier than a large egg. And one more, if you ever want to like do something kind of like a sandwich or something, you want to basically sub in quail eggs for chicken eggs on volume. Three of them are about what makes a standard chicken egg. And if you get the large rings for like the wide mouth mason jars, spray a little bit of oil on them and set those down and put three in there. You can cook them sunny side up. They come out perfectly round. And if you oil them first, they won't stick and they'll pop right off for you. Or you can flip them. But I find quail eggs are real easy to do sunny side because there's not much yolk to work with. So there's some add-ons there. Next up, Blitz here. This time from Matt Sursley on how to change the problem that children can be expensive and always want money into a multiple-headed solution. Like, when you want money, you got to do something for it. Two, it has to be something useful. And three, you got to help daddy cut his tax bill. With that, here we go with Matt Sursley.
Hey, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sursley of AgoristTaxAdvice.com. Here to talk to you about my very, very favorite way to save money on taxes if you qualify. If you have a business and you have kids, you should hire your kids. Well, unless they have another job already and make a lot of money. But hiring kids is an absolutely fantastic way to save money on your taxes. Let's say you're a pretty ordinary individual paying 24% on your taxes. And let's say you got a kid who's 14 years old, 15 years old, and they work in your business. So you pay them $5,000 for actual work they do. They get a standard deduction. Actually, this year it's $15,000. So they owe no income taxes on that $5,000. You just saved that 24%. Even better, there are times when if you have what's called a Schedule C or a sole proprietorship or a partnership, if you're partners with the parent of the child, that you don't owe any of the nasty FICA taxes on them either at 15.3% that you probably do owe on yourself at least some percentage of that. So maybe you're really at a 30% or a 35% tax rate on that money, and suddenly you go to 0%. But Even if you do owe that FICA taxes, you're going from a real tax rate of 30% down to 15%. You're coming out ahead. Now, you don't just give them this money to put into their bank and for them to spend the way they want to. Although, if they do good work, you probably should give them some of the money to spend the way they want to. You can use this money to pay for things that you were paying for them anyway. So, my favorite example, my oldest kid is in Scouts. I guess it's Scouts of America now instead of Boy Scouts. So I pay her to work in my business, and then all of the camping fees, all of the summer camp fees, the cost of a new tent, the cost of new boots, the cost of all of her camping gear, well, I take that money out of her bank account. And that way, basically, we're not paying any income tax on that money because she doesn't owe any income taxes because she didn't make enough money. Now, you can't make your kids pay for rent. You can't make them pay for food. You can't make them pay for medical care. You can't make them pay for necessities, but you can make them pay for luxuries. New clothes are not a necessity. Clothing is, but you can get stuff from the thrift store. But if they want that new fancy clothing, make them buy it themselves. It is really, really easy to find work for kids to do. And you might say, well, yeah, if that's a 15-year-old, I got a 2-year-old. What work can they do? Anyone can be a model. Take photos of them, put them up on your website, put them on your business card, pay them $500, maybe $1,000 for the modeling session. You know, do 2 modeling sessions a year. You know, you're not going to retire on that money, but that's putting a couple $100 into your pocket. And now let's say you got a lot of money. Let's say you're somebody who's, you know, maxing out everything, 401ks, sold the 401ks, you're putting aside all the money you need, you want to give your kids a real head start. This is earned income, which means they can put this money into a Roth IRA. Roth IRAs are really, really good because they are completely tax-free on all the gains. So if you put in $100,000 into a Roth IRA and it goes up to $500,000 and you comply with the rules for taking that money out, usually wait until you're 59 and a half, that money comes out tax-free. The downside to a Roth IRA is you got to pay the taxes now. But your kids don't owe any taxes now. So it's basically tax-free going in and tax-free coming out. I cannot think of a way to set up your kids for more success in life financially than doing this. Now, again, you better be maxing out everything for yourself. You know, you gotta take care of yourself when that mask pops down on the airplane before you take care of the person next to you. But if you are doing fine and you really want to put them on a head start, paying them money so that they can then put money into their own Roth IRA is a phenomenal way to get them started. Now, all of this works with people who aren't your kids too. You want to hire your grandkids? You want to hire your niece or your nephew? You want to hire your brother or sister? This all works the same way, except for any of those other people, you're going to owe those 15% FICA taxes no matter what. So you're not going to save as much money. But if you're already helping somebody out financially, if you're already giving money to somebody to pay for their rent or something, see if you can hire them. Now, if they're on disability or something, you really can't. But this can be a great way for you to save money and them to get more money, essentially, by going through all this and paying them instead of by giving them the money. They've actually got to do work. It's got to be a reasonable wage. There's other tricks to jump through. If you're doing it for $1,000 or $2,000, don't worry about it. If you're paying people $30,000 or $40,000 a year, work with me, work with the CPA to make sure you're dotting your I's and crossing your T's. Run payroll if you've got to. And here's the last thing, you have to follow your state's employment laws. This doesn't work very well in California because kids in California basically can't work until they're 14 years old. And even then, there's limits. Works great in Texas. Also, watch out, there may be state taxes on this. I'm just saying it's federally tax-free. But still, even if they owe state taxes on it, you are going to owe those state taxes anyway. So you're still breaking even or coming ahead on the state taxes too. Again, this is my absolutely favorite, very favorite way to save money on taxes. If you've got kids, if you've got a business, if it's a profitable business, and if you're spending money on your kids, hire them and pay them. Final thing, if they're older, if they're in college, there may be ways that you can pay tuition assistance for your employee, and now that's tax deductible. So this works even after they're older, different tricks, different tactics for different phases of life. Well, anyway, I've got a whole lot more to talk about on kids. If you are interested in talking about this with me, please reach out to me. I've got a link, www.agoristtaxadvice.com/PSP. That'll get you a free report on ways to save money in your business. And eventually you'll get an email that will schedule a free call with me to see if I can help you save even more money. I want a win-win-win situation. You get more money, I get less money, and the IRS gets way less money. Thanks. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Well, I was listening to that, and he was about two-thirds through, and I'm thinking, Roth IRA, there it hit, right? I completely agree with the idea of, like, you're paying your kids, and, you know, you can say you're saving half your money, whether you like it or not, because dad's the one, or mom's the one with the checkbook. And that's how this is going to work, and we're going to instill this habit into you very long. You can make them save 75%. You can make them save whatever you want. The beauty of that is the younger you do it, and this is what you don't do. You don't set it up for them and then say, it's done, don't worry about it. You need to, about once every month, or at least once every quarter, show them how their Roth IRA is growing. Now, let's say you start doing this with a kid when they're about 10 years old. I'm not going to worry about how much money's going to be in there, because it's going to be a function of what you invest in and how much you pay them and how much you make them put in. But there will be a significant amount after 8 years. But it's 8 years. Let's say you do a quarterly review with them like you're their financial advisor. So that's 32 times that you'll sit down with that kid and go, look, we've been putting this money in. This is the allocations that we have. This is how it's growing. And this is your money for you to retire with. And when you take this money out, no one will ever be able to take a dime from you in taxes in it. The education value of that is probably worth more than the monetary value of that. I wish someone had done that for me. Because here's the other side of it. Their first couple jobs are probably not going to have 401ks. And services will go set up a Roth. They don't know how. Your kids will, but they'll already have one. All they'll literally have to do is link, you know, make sure you get them a bank account too. And then link so they can make contributions but not withdrawals. Don't trust them with that. And once they have that, from the day they start working, they can be making their own contributions to it. If you get a kid to put $100 a month into a Roth IRA and they start working at 18 and they stop at 28, even with the most conservative, boring investments, they still retire a millionaire. Did you know that? But if you have 8 years ahead of time and you put that good mindset in, they'll probably save a hell of a lot more than that and for a hell of a lot longer. And it is one of the greatest gifts you can give your kids. And at the same time, sticking it to the man. You know, sticking it to the man and being like, look, I'm not giving you this money. I'm giving it to my kid. Then I'm deducting it. And you can't tax them because they don't make enough money yet. It's absolutely a brilliant strategy, and it's definitely one that we employed when my son was much younger. All right, next, we got a listener who's found some jerry cans, but some of them are not quite what they were when they were born. They need a little rehabbing. Are they safe to use? All of that and more from Ryan Steva.
Hey, TSP community, this is Ryan from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I have a question from Kevin, and Kevin asks, how do you clean out a used 5-gallon military jerry can to be used safely for storing gas? His details are that he is wanting to implement Jack's recommendation of 60 gallons of stored gas in rotation. So congratulations, Kevin. That is an absolutely great goal to go towards. Sure, all of you know this is the idea that you store 5 gallons per month. And you store that over the course of a year, and then the next year, each month, you use the gas from that month of storage from the previous year, so that your gas is never more than a year old. You dump that into your car, you go fill it up, and you store that again. So that's a great way to have a good rotation of fresh gas in the case of an emergency without actually putting a whole bunch of money into preps. So His additional details on that are that he picked up several metal jerry cans for $6 each, which is a great price, but he isn't sure what was stored in them and doesn't want to contaminate the gas that he puts into them. He also states that one of the cans has some rust in it and that the others don't appear to. So let's deal with the low-hanging fruit here first, which is the cans that don't have rust in them. So if you have cans that just have a little bit of debris and you're trying to get them out, my personal recommendation is to use a small amount of gasoline. It's going to essentially be sacrificial, but you're going to pour it in there and you don't want to shake it hard. You want to basically roll it around gently because you don't want to get those vapors basically building up pressure in there ideally. So you're going to kind of roll that around gently and try to pick up all the debris inside with a small amount of gasoline. And then you're going to pour that into a container for disposal later. So you're going to do that with all of your containers. Then once you've done that, look through the containers and make sure that you've gotten all of the debris and other things out of them. If you haven't, do that process once more to try to get as much as possible out. Now, some of these cans have an interior lining that can flake. And if you're seeing that happen, I would highly recommend using either not using them or using a filter funnel, so a funnel with a fairly fine filter on it, to make sure that when you fill anything up with one of these cans, that if there is any of the flaking of the interior coating, that gets caught in the funnel rather than going in the gas tank that you're filling. So that's kind of the low-hanging fruit, the easy part. That's my recommendation. Some people are saying clean these cans out with water or other, even like isopropyl alcohol. My preference is just to use gasoline because that's what's supposed to be stored in them, so you don't have to worry about trying to evaporate all of it or anything else. So that's the easy one. The gas can with rust in it, now this can actually be applied across the board with metal gas cans, but there is a lot of infighting on the internet about this, so take it all with a grain of salt. I have used this method before, but you can use acid to clean out the inside of that can. Typically that you see people using either a cleaning vinegar, so a 6% vinegar, or a muriatic acid that is watered down to 25% or less muriatic acid to 75% or more water. Now keep in mind when you're using something like muriatic acid, as Micro says, safety third, which you should go look up. It's an interesting concept. But anyways, make sure that if you're using muriatic acid, that you're using proper safety precautions, you know, gloves, eye protection, etc., and that you have baking soda on hand to neutralize if you spill any or create a mess. Now, the way that you would typically do this is you would fill it slightly over halfway full. So you'd make a solution of about 2.5 gallons or just a little bit more. And then you're going to pour that in, lay the gas can on one side for maybe 12 to 24 hours, and then flip it over. And so that way the acid is touching all the different surfaces in that container without having to fill it all the way up. And then once it's sat for that long, you're going to pour that out into some type of disposal container that is safe for acid. So make sure that you're using something like HDPE container to pour that muriatic acid and water solution into, and then you want to neutralize it and get rid of it however you're going to get rid of it. But then you're going to check inside, make sure that it's eaten away all the rust. Now, this can still be a bit of an issue. You know, you're going to have pitting on the container. You could have metal pieces that flake off and things. So you may or may not want to use the container depending on how much rust was in it and how thoroughly you feel like you've been able to clean it out. But that is generally how people are cleaning these tanks out. You can also get, there is a product called Evaporust, and there's a couple other products as well that are specifically intended for cleaning out gas tanks or dealing with rust on surfaces, but they are quite expensive and they don't seem to work any better than the muriatic acid, and they don't seem to do any less damage than the muriatic acid. So from what I can tell and from my personal experience, the muriatic acid, if the can is in decent shape, should be able to strip off all of that rust. There are sealants that some people put on and swear by, and some people say are completely unnecessary, but sealants like a POR 15 fuel tank sealer, and I'll provide links in the show notes for this, can help seal off that tank and basically provide a rust-proof coating or oxygen-proof coating that is also resistant to gasoline, just to keep that tank safer for longer. But in the case of an old jerry can, I probably wouldn't be especially concerned about that. So those are the primary considerations. Like I said, take it with a bit of a grain of salt, because there is a lot of back and forth on the internet about these methods and how well they work and how good they are to use. But my experience is that if the tank is actually in decent shape, that this should clean it quite well and should leave it fairly rust-free as long as you keep the tank topped off with gasoline and don't allow oxygen into that space. All right, that is it for me. Thank you, Kevin, for getting that question in. If anybody else has questions on homesteading, home inspection, creative problem solving, and other similar solutions, feel free to send those questions into Jack. I would be happy to get those answered for you. And if you want to find out more about me and what I do, if you visit thehomesteadconsultant.com, you can find out more about that. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And remember, until next time, go get your hands dirty.
Well, I had a TV flashback there for a moment when he said safety third with Mike Rowe. I don't know that that rates a show, but maybe someday we'll do a segment on just that. But the brief version of that, if you don't really feel like looking it up or you're going to forget about it, it's not that safety isn't important. Safety third means safety is important, but it's not the most important thing. It shouldn't override things like common sense, personal responsibility, or getting the job done. Rowe uses it to highlight how overemphasizing safety can create complacency and truly impair production and getting things done. We've all seen some of the dumbass FEMA-based safety videos and shit that just don't make any sense at all. And at the same time, safety is important. So make sure that you're taking precautions, but let's not become paralyzed by the safety police. With that, let's move on and talk about tractor and chickens on a gravel driveway for weed control.
Hey, Nick Ferguson here with Homegrown Liberty Consulting and RarePlantStore.com, and I've got a question from Nick. This is not the same Nick, obviously. Can I tractor chickens on my gravel driveway? I have a fairly large and wide gravel driveway in full sun with lots of weeds growing out of it. I have a chicken tractor with around 10 laying hens and plenty of lawn space to move the tractor. Is it safe to tractor the chickens on the driveway from time to time with the intent to maintain the weeds in the driveway and also feed the chickens? Will this injure the chickens' feet? Nah. The driveway was sprayed with herbicide for several years by the previous owners, but has not been sprayed in over a year. Depending on the time of year, the plants in the driveway can consist of dandelion, grasses, clover, chickweed, henbit, purslane, hairy bittercress, dead nettle, fleabane, pineapple weed, and a few others. Thank you, Nick. Great question, and I have a quick and easy answer for you. Yes, you can tractor them across the driveway. They'll snack on most of those weeds just fine. They'll enjoy taking up some of the smaller gravel bits as grit for their gizzards, which is, both of those things are perfectly fine. However, you really don't want to leave them on there for long. Their feet will be just fine. I wouldn't worry about that at all. But the main issue I see is going to be adding manure to their driveway, which will actually help the weeds grow even more. It's going to add organic matter to the driveway, which is just going to make it kind of muddier. Those are kind of the things that you don't want. You don't want that fine particulate matter building up humus in your driveway. You want to keep it dry and free of humus and stuff that's going to be, you know, you don't want to be feeding the soil on a driveway, really. And so, I wouldn't do it. Personally, I'd tractor them up against the edges of the driveway so they can still get some grit. And then I would manage the weeds in the driveway with like something like a flame weeder or periodic solarization. You can get a lot of solarizing done in an afternoon. Like you could have all the plastic rolled off to the side. You drive past it. You unroll the plastic while you're gone to work or whatever, if you're working away from home. And then when you get home in the afternoon or the evening, you stop short of it and then roll the plastic back off the side and then drive on past it. The only issue with solarizing that driveway is going to be making sure that nobody else drives across the plastic, like UPS or post office or anything like that, because the plastic's going to get ruined. So yeah, short and simple. Yes, you can, but the main purpose in tractoring is to give a large volume, both volume and, you know, species of both insects and plants for them to eat, as well as directly applying the manure where it's going to do some good for the pasture. And the problem is both of those purposes are hindered by tractoring them over gravel, even if there are some weeds and a nice selection of them. You'd honestly be better served using a shovel to cut the weeds than raking them to where the tractor will go next. Honestly, I just keep a shovel and a rake next to the tractor or on the tractor, and just take 5 minutes, run a shovel or hoe over some of the weeds every day, every time that you're moving the tractor, quickly rake them up every time you're going to plan on moving it, and then just toss them in the path of where the tractor's going to be next, and then drag it over top of the weeds, then they can eat the weeds. You've actually removed the biomass. You have not added any nitrogen or manure or anything like that to your driveway. You're actually drying it out. You're removing as much plant material as you can. All of that stuff is ideal. And that's actually going to make the driveway better over time and improve the pasture more than if you were tractoring directly on the driveway. Keep the questions coming, guys. I'm working on scheduling for consulting all summer. It looks like this year is going to be an extensive one. I'm headed all over the USA and will be hitting pretty much every single state east of the Mississippi and all the states that touch that river as well, with a few jaunts over to the Rockies being likely. So get your emails sent. I'm going to be hitting probably more states than I have ever hit in a summer this year. So get those emails sent. I have a bonus for everyone who signs up this summer for consulting that you will not want to miss out on. Details to come soon. Put consulting in the subject line and send that email to nick@homegrownliberty.com. Do good things.
All right, I agree with Nick, and I agree with his conclusion that you can do it. It won't hurt the chickens, but I wouldn't do it. And let me add to it. He was talking about the particulate matter and all. The reason you're having so many weeds pop up in your driveway is gravel is actually exceptional at, believe it or not, building soil. Gravel, rock base, all of it is way better than you'd think. And it's because it's such a rough textured surface that literally all dust, which is generally organic matter that blows across it, is trapped. And it falls down as that fine particulate matter that he was talking about and forms little pockets, and little pockets then get pioneers growing and roots themselves build soil. And this is so much the case that I went as far with this recently to try to prevent it, that where we put the pump for our pool, it always gets overgrown with grass and the grass gets up in the pump, and that causes more likely for it to overheat in the summer, and you can't just mow it, you gotta go in there and weed eat it. So I'm like, I'm gonna stop this shit and I'll put gravel down. So I did that when we first moved in, and of course immediately everything grew up through the gravel. So then I pulled all the gravel out the way, moved the pump out of the way in the next winter, and put down like two layers of cardboard and put the gravel back and put the pump back. And it didn't take, you know, 2 months in the spring before everything was growing up through it again. Well, now I'm getting like a boomer dad, you know, like a boomer redneck dad where he's fixed to kick your ass and adjusting his belt and all. And like, I'm like, I'll show your ass. So I had a leftover piece of pond liner, 25 mil thick, screw you, weeds. You ain't growing through this shit, so I trimmed it to have a pretty good overlap outside the footprint of the pump and did it all over again and set the... And it's basically river rock, so it looks nice. And set that there and put my pump back. And I even got this little thing that looks like a little... covered wagon shaped thing, like a chicken covered wagon size. It goes over the pump. It keeps the sun off the pump to keep it from getting too hot with the sun beating down on it by giving it shade and letting it breathe. You ain't got no sun. It's too dark in there. You got heat from the pump, and now you can't come up from below because you got 25 and weeds. It took a while, but the weeds started growing in there anyway. And I went to, weeds, I'll pull them out. Yeah, they didn't come through the rubber at all. The dadgone gravel grew enough soil of its own to support things like weeds. And so one of the things you'll just have to accept if you're using a gravel surface is that even if it works for a while, it's going to grow weeds. And so I agree that like a weed flamer is probably the easiest solution to this. You know, assuming your driveway's not like a half a mile long or something like that, you could walk your driveway once every 3 weeks during the growing season and knock that crap down. And it ain't a big deal that some of it's there. It's that if it's there long enough, it keeps aggravating the problem. And sooner or later, anybody that's ever maintained gravel driveways or roads knows you got to bring more gravel in. It's just the way it is. And then think about this while you're doing it. Not only does it catch all that particulate matter, not only do the pioneers make soil for the next generation, every time you're bringing gravel in, some of that gravel, you know, all that gravel's been crushed or whatnot to meet a certain size requirement, and it's got tons of dust in it, and dust, rock dust, is what we put in our gardens because it's a micro... You see what I'm saying? It's actually a much better growing environment than we think it is my shot on it. With all that in mind, let's go talk about something totally different, a nutritional thing, lowering your A1C with Andy McCann.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, here where I own CrossFit Garage. I am here to help you with your health and fitness questions. I've been living this life since I retired as an electrical engineer, so about 20 years. Well, actually, it's been about maybe 15 years. Anyway, I'm here to answer your questions. I got a question from Jay that we're going to go into about A1C. Guys, if you need help and you're here, great, come to the gym. If you're not, we have some online resources for you. I'm putting it all in a page just for this audience. So if you go to CrossFitGarage.com/TSPC, you'll see a whole bunch of stuff. I'm going to turn this episode into a full episode. It'll be 204, and it's going to be on A1C. So there's a lot of guys at my gym asking this exact same question, and I got a text from Jay. Yes, if you text me, I will totally answer the question. He and I have been texting back and forth, and I said, you know what? This is really good. I've been talking to the guys in the gym. I'm going to turn it into an episode for today, and I'll scoot my today episode till next week. But anyway, here is his question. Besides dropping weight, what are a couple things I can do to drop my A1C for a fasting blood check coming up in a few weeks? All right, so some background detail. He is 55, just like a lot of us, right? I did a podcast the other day. I didn't know this, and I guess I should have because of the business I'm in, but basically when men turn 50, we enter the drop-dead years. So basically, up until you're 50, it's accidents and suicide that kill us the most. And then the number increases dramatically, like 3 times, and it becomes strokes and heart attacks. So basically, bad blood, blood getting clot. So this is something, right? What is my blood doing? I have an A1C count, and how do I lower it? He's a cop out in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And he wants to be in better health. So it's good, he says, I know I probably can lose some weight, but what else can I do? And we're going to go through some of those things. So he also noted that his numbers got pre-diabetic. And so, yeah, I mean, this is unfortunately, this isn't unusual for us men. It's just crazy. We don't really take care of ourselves relying on our high school or maybe some college fitness. And then we hit 50 and we think, oh, dang, it's not too late. But it would certainly be nice if you started earlier. But the same thing with like planting a tree. When's the best time? Today. Or the next best time? Tomorrow, right? So, or I guess it was yesterday and then today, whatever. Anyway, do this stuff better in the past. But hey, start now. So what can he do? So I'm going to go through in no specific order, but there's probably one of these that you guys will go, oh, that, I don't do that. Key in on that. If you don't do a thing, try the thing. So the first one is walk after every meal. If you walk for about 10 to 15 minutes after you eat, for whatever reason, it has a huge impact on that insulin spike. So get out and walk. Shrink your eating window. Now, don't be dumb. Don't shrink it. Well, I guess you could do the one meal a day. If you're doing carnivore, you're probably doing that anyway. But intermittent fasting or shrinking your window is going to help in that response as well. The other one is cut your carbs. Now, look, Jack and I have been talking about this for a while. Jack's been talking about it forever. Dr. Ken Berry's been talking about it for even longer. Go carnivore. Go lion diet. If you've got other weird things going on in your body, the lion diet seems to be awesome. I'm going to do a whole thing on Evan and his Crohn's, and I guess a part four. But we've had great success having him on the lion diet. And doing some other stuff. So, of course, if you cut out carbs, then it's going to reduce the spike altogether because you're not eating of that stuff. I've been doing this carnivore for about 9 months. Actually, I guess we'll be going on 10 months soon. And essentially, all I eat is ruminant meat, eggs, salt, and goat cheese. I did add in some spicy stuff, so I've got something, it's some sort of like, you know, refrigerated spice, so it's chili peppers and something, just to give me a different taste. But yeah, 9 months in, I'm not bored of it. You can do this too. It's not for the faint of heart. It is not easy, but get rid of those carbs. The other one, which is kind of not as well known, is get better sleep. So if you're having trouble sleeping, there's a lot of things you can do. Actually, I have a podcast on that. You can go research it, but there's like, make sure the room is dark, make sure your phones are off, make sure there's some brown noise, all that sort of stuff. The last one, which is kind of weird to think this even affects it, is stress. Not so much, yes, we know stress, but the weird one to get out of stress is to practice vitamin G, and that's gratitude. Just say things you're thankful for. When I do chores, I say thanks to whatever. Like, I'm thankful that I've got a job. I'm thankful that I have a business. I'm thankful the sky is blue. Whatever. It doesn't really matter. I think it's just that you're turning your words into positiveness. Yeah, I know this can kind of get foo-foo and woo-woo or super religious, none of which I really am. Yes, I'm a believer, but I don't know. There's this weird thing about speaking things out loud, or at least in your head, that really helps. So it's like with a goal. If you write it down, you're more likely to achieve it. If you write it down and say it every day, you're way more likely to achieve it. So those are some things. And a couple other random ones are cold exposure, which I'm not a fan of. And I know this is going to sound strange coming from the CrossFit guy, lifting heavy weights. If you're going to lift and lift heavy and just do it for the fact of your A1C, then use a back squat and a deadlift. If you don't have a great rig, don't do the back squat. Just do a deadlift. You want, in this case, to get pretty heavy. So you're doing maybe 5 sets of 5. You want to be really stressed on that last rep, and you probably can't even make it. So the last one's a set of 4. That's what you want to do on that. The other one that you could try is wearing a continuous glucose monitor to see where the spikes are. Weirdly, you may find that it's all stress-induced, in which case, yeah, start Wim Hof breathing and start reducing that stress. All right, guys, again, you can find me on my podcast, Food, Fitness, and Finance. This will be podcast episode 204. I will turn it into a big episode with lots of color commentary and other stuff and some other things that Jay and I texted about. All right, guys, if you have a question, I am here to help. Y'all take care.
So I got a few follow-ups on this one, and it seems an appropriate time for an announcement. Andy recommended Doc Ken Berry, and Ken will always be a friend. There's no ill will here, but Ken is no longer a member of the Expert Council. And it is simply because Ken's a very busy man, and what will happen is I'll go 5 months or more without getting answers from him, and then I'll get a slew of answers in one day, and I won't get any answers from him for a lot longer. And that means people are asking at times time-sensitive questions, because there are times that what I usually do is I do my Expert Council answers in the order that they come in with some adjustments, so there's not like 3 Andy McCanns in a row, right? But there are things that are topical, like I'm going for surgery or I'm going to go on a vacation soon, right? And I'll push those up. And when people write in to talk to a doctor, a lot of times it's time sensitive, and I can't have them waiting 4 or 5 months expecting an answer, then just giving up. And it's just not good for the show. The truth is, if Ken had been anybody else, this includes like who he is, his reputation, plus as a personal friend, I would have cut him a year ago. So I've just quietly, without any fanfare, he's no longer an Expert Council member. I think that Andy will do a good job with questions on these subjects going forward, and I can handle them myself. But I am open to another person who is in this specific niche, the diet side, because Andy's more the fitness side, adding to the council, and an MD would be preferable. I do have a very, I guess, casual, very light online relationship with Sean Baker, who I always loved his work. I'll reach out, but he's another super busy guy, so I don't know if he has time for something like this, but I'd like to bring someone into that niche because it is very valuable. Again, nothing I said should be taken as a negative about Ken. It is not the first time we've had people either remove themselves or removed from the council for this, who we still have great relationships with, like Charles Sandville, the humble mechanic. That's exactly what happened there years and years ago, and he still pops up in live feeds all the time. And he's still welcome here all the time, and so is Ken. So there's no negatives to Ken in this. I'm just letting you know, if you send a question in for him, I'm either going to send it to somebody else, or I'm going to kick it back to you and restate what I just did in the email more briefly. Next, though, I do want to talk about two things Andy recommended that I don't want you to overlook, because I don't want to always be the guy jumping on the keto carnivore shit and saying, yeah, just do that, because not everybody's going to do it. But the walk after you eat is one of the most beneficial things that you can do, and it doesn't have to be much. I'll point out that if you're walking at anything approaching a speed where somebody behind you isn't ready to kill you if they can't get around you, anything faster than that, there's no way that you're taking, let's say, more than about 15 minutes to walk a mile. And a one-mile walk will do wonders for pulling that blood pressure spike down. And if you'll simply go like level one of what we teach for better diet, limit carbs to 100 a day, which is a freaking lot in reality, and all whole foods, no seed oils, no bullshit, no processed things out of a bag or a box. If you'll do that and add a walk, you'll be in great shape. The sleep thing, I also completely agree with, but sometimes we have trouble getting to sleep. And I'm going to give you two products that are both MSB partner vendors here that will help with that if you have that issue. One is a CBD and CBN formula from Angie's Gardens. This is a relatively expensive product, but you don't need much of it per use. And it is more effective as a sleep aid than frickin' Valium, with no addictive or, what is the other word I'm looking for, like negative side effects at all. All it does is make you sleep. It's called Sleep Formula. It's 700 milligrams of CBD and 300 milligrams of CBN. CBN is a master cannabinoid, so it's a cannabinoid. So if you are, you know, ruthlessly P-tested at work, this may not be for you, though this is completely legal and has no THC in it. But I'll just tell you, this is not an optional thing. Once you use it, you're going to go to sleep. And you're going to sleep your ass off. And it is fantastic. And you will not feel high and you will not feel buzzed unless you're some rare bird or something. But no one I've talked to that's ever used this stuff has felt in any way weird, other than just about 15 minutes after you take it, your eyes get really, really freaking heavy. And when you lay down to go to sleep, a couple good deep breaths, and you are freaking out. And you're probably not getting up until it's time to get up, or you have to pee in the middle of the night. The other option, now this is more of, will have a psychoactive effect on you mentally. You may or may not like it. But the Delta 8 gummies from the Kira Botanicals, the deep sleep formula, those to me are just a sledgehammer good night. I'll take one of those about 15 minutes before bed. I feel a little bit tired. I don't sleep quite as hard as I do with the CBD-CBN formula, and I don't mind a little bit of the dream stimulation and things that go along with that. So it's not really a recreational use. It's more of a lifestyle use, small amount in the evenings. But what I will tell you is I have noticed that sometimes I have to take two of them now, and sometimes I just won't take them for about a week. I'll use something else, or I'll use nothing to not build up too much of a tolerance. And I think that can happen with any of these products. I'm not suggesting that these make you healthier or whatever. I'm just saying if you need a sleep aid, both of those are fantastic. And a little bit of self-promotion, as I mentioned about MSB at the beginning today. If you're using products like this and you are not an MSB member, don't worry about how it helps me. Worry about how it helps you, because if you don't have the membership for something like this, you hate money, because it will more than pay you back. And anytime you can make your dollars in hand more at the end of the year than less, you should take that opportunity. Anyway, with that, let's move on and talk about, well, it is time, I guess, for my segment. I thought we had one more here. Oh, no, we do. Dr. Bones on Girardia. Let's go ahead and hit that one, and then we'll do my final segment.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Recently, I wrote an article on Doom and Bloom discussing the topic of infection with parasitic worms. Now, while some of these can reach impressive lengths, like a 55-foot tapeworm, yep, that actually happened, most parasites that trouble humans are actually microscopic in nature. The most common of these in the U.S. is Giardia. Over 1 million Americans are affected annually. An infection with Giardia is called giardiasis. The parasite lives all over the world in bodies of water. It's ingested during the stage of its life cycle called a cyst. The Giardia cyst is a dormant stage that survives until it finds a host. It then colonizes the small intestine and, for lack of a better word, hatches. Giardia then feeds off the host's dietary nutrients. Once it reproduces, the parasite reverts back to the cyst stage and exits in the bowel movement. Giardia especially thrives in poorly developed regions where public sanitation is questionable. It spreads easily from host to host, with children being affected more than adults. Although it prefers bodies of water, child care centers are a possible source of outbreaks in the United States. Giardiasis can cause a variety of intestinal symptoms, which can range from pretty mild to pretty darn severe. In about half the cases, there are no symptoms at all. If a person does become ill, symptoms will occur in 1 to 2 weeks after the actual infection. This is the time it takes the Giardia cyst to hatch and mature. Once that happens, common symptoms include watery diarrhea, greasy appearing bowel movements that float, abdominal pain, gas and bloating, nausea and vomiting, loss of appetite, worsening fatigue, weight loss, and dehydration. Less commonly, sufferers complain of itchiness, hives, swelling in the joints, and around the eyes. Most people have symptoms for 2 to 6 weeks. There are people who will have longer-lasting symptoms, but fortunately, the infection usually resolves itself. Some people, however, continue to have symptoms for weeks or months. Whether you're an animal or a human, you can get giardiasis, passing it on to others through your excrement. Other common ways for Giardia to enter a host include eating or drinking contaminated food or unfiltered water, contaminated surfaces, contact with that, travel to regions with poor sanitation, swimming in contaminated water, contact with babies and toddlers or their diapers that have the infection, or having anal sex with an infected person. Possible complications of giardiasis, they include dehydration. Dehydration is a primary risk from giardiasis, as the nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea can cause a large amount of fluid loss. You can also have GI problems. If giardiasis lasts a long time, it can damage the lining of your small intestine, which can damage its ability to absorb nutrients. And autoimmune disease. With severe chronic giardiasis, part of your immune system to the infection becomes hyperactive, continuing even after the infection is gone. Giardiasis is diagnosed with certainty by identifying the organism in stool samples under the microscope. Most of the time, however, the specific set of symptoms that I mentioned earlier are the main clue that triggers treatment. And speaking of treatment, there are various antiparasitic drugs that are commonly used to treat significant illness caused by Giardia. Using metronidazole or a number of other antibiotics you'd laugh to hear me try to pronounce, you can expect recovery in about a week. Luckily, metronidazole is the most commonly used and is actually available even in veterinary antibiotics, but it may cause complications during a pregnancy, so therefore probably shouldn't use it during that time. As Giardia can live even in the clearest creek water in the backcountry, it might be hard to avoid off the grid. However, there are strategies to help prevent problems. Wash your hands frequently, especially after eating or having sex, and after using the bathroom or contact with soil or animals. If someone in your group has been sick, clean and disinfect everything they've touched, including work surfaces and bedding. Wash fruits and vegetables in clean water before you eat them. Avoid raw foods and unbottled water when traveling abroad. And be wary when swimming in natural ponds, streams, and lakes. Even municipal swimming pools are risky if they're not well maintained. Try not to swallow water in these areas. Although animals can spread Giardia to people, you're unlikely to get a Giardia infection from dogs or cats. The type of Giardia that makes people sick is usually not the same type that affects pets. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
You know, good stuff. And again, for all of the talk about things like gunshot wounds and, you know, spurting arteries and sucking chest wounds and all, the most likely thing that you would have to deal with as, you know, a group medic or something like that in a grid down scenario, even a relatively short one of a few, 3-4 weeks to a month, is things like this. And knowing how to treat it and how to prevent it is incredibly important. All right, with that, let's go ahead and I'm going to talk about my segment, which what we're talking about today is what I'm calling the trade war domino theory. And here's what I mean by trade war domino theory. Trump's pretty much declared a trade war on the whole world. Now, not to the level that the TV and the idiots on cable news tell you, but it's basically like everybody has a big threat of huge U.S. tariffs, and everybody's got more tariff. Most people have more tariff than they ever had, even though they're relatively modest versus the tariffs that they have been applying to us for a very, very long time. The only exception is China has a massive tariff, pretty much knocking out a huge amount of goods from China is even being worth shipping to the United States right now, and that's beginning to dry up, and so the world's going to end. The reality, though, is all of these other nations that are in kind of a grace period right now because they've indicated that they're willing to make deals, and they have small tariffs like 10% on them across the board, all of them are lining up to talk. And what I mean by a domino theory is, again, back when I was in high school, I think it's probably about 11th grade, I had a really great history teacher named Dr. Larson, and he went deep into the Vietnam War, probably more so than many other history teachers even in my school or at the time, because he was a Vietnam veteran. He actually served as a forward observer as a second lieutenant in the late 60s. Because he got out of college, he didn't go straight for his PhD, and he had gone ROTC, and so off you go. And so that's why he covered it a lot. He explained domino theory to us, and even back then, you know, he thought it was preposterous. He said it was the dumbest thing ever, but it worked because propaganda works. This is a guy that probably would get fired as a teacher today. Basically said the whole way this was presented is the case was made to the American people. If we don't stop communism in Vietnam, it'll just domino theory fall through the whole, like Australia will be freaking communist in 20 years. Like it'll just cascade through Japan, all through the eastern nations, etc. Everything will be communist. And of course we had the Red Scare going on, and also, yeah, we've got to stop communism by sending your kids to a war to get their balls blown off in a place that most people couldn't find on a map without a label on it. And so that was the domino theory. And it's the same thing they're trying to do now. If we don't stop Russia and Ukraine, this little sliver Donbass region, Putin's going to run all through Europe. Also, he's literally running out of bullets in Ukraine by themselves. Can defeat him if we'll just help. But he's going to take all of you. You see, it's a dumb thing. Doesn't mean that domino theories can't work. And, of course, domino theories are based on the concept. We line a bunch of dominoes up, tip one over, and they all go down if we tip the right one first. So with the trade war, what I'm saying is there are nations that will make deals. And every time one nation makes a deal, other nations are going to want to make deals, and that will have a cascading effect. And it basically works out like this. The United States is the biggest market in the world. And I'll explain in a minute how big, how much bigger we are than any other market in the world for export driven economies. So losing access to American consumers hurts more than any other market shutdown. If you went to any country that relies on exports as a key part of their GDP, there is nothing you could take from them. There's no three things you could take for them that hurts more than just losing access to the United States. And that's, you know, triply true in China. The next is there's a fantastic reality here. We call it in business first mover advantage, and basically early movers gain the most. The people that step up first, that are most amicable to making a deal, they're going to get a better deal than the people that come to the party last. Kind of like Bitcoin, everybody gets the price that they deserve. So the countries that cut deals, as they start to see, the ones that ain't, when they see a country like Vietnam or Japan cut a deal, they're like, we better do something, because if enough countries cut deals to solve the problem for the United States, maybe we don't need to give you a deal at all, or maybe you get a shittier deal. And Trump is just a bitter enough prick that if he feels that you have somehow been not a nice person, or not a nice country, as he likes to say, you're not being very nice to interviewers, and really makes him look stupid when he does that, you might be a little bit more left out. So that starts more of the cascade. And the reality is, we talk about how our stock market price went down. You know, if you need money out of the stock market, you shouldn't have money in the stock market. Right. If you're 65 years old and you're retiring next year and you have all your money in your 401k and IRA and all leveraged into high-value stocks, you're pretty stupid at that point. You shouldn't have to sell just because the market went down. You should have some portion at least allocated for that eventuality. But, you know, my point is that the supposed misery that happened for a couple of days when Freedom Day came wasn't really misery. It's just the TV told you it was, so you were unhappy. It really didn't have any major impact whatsoever on your life. It still hasn't, and tariffs have not really affected 99% of you in any real way or any meaningful way at all, even though you think they have because they told you it did. Now, there are some people I know that are in some pretty unique niche businesses. This is already starting to impact them in particular, and they will feel it, but no one is going to feel it like the nations on the other end of it. We're not closing plants. We're not closing factories in America. We're not closing down production facilities. We're not laying off thousands of workers. But that happened in Canada, and it's really happening in China. In other words, I'm telling you is, we can be a bully here because we really do have the most force. And I'm not saying we should. I'm just telling you what's happening. This is not a moral judgment. This is not rah-rah orange man. I'm just telling you what's happening and how this is going to play out. No one wants the left be left behind. So again, you get a few people making some deals because they're starting to hurt. Everybody starts coming to Jesus real fast with this. And you're going to start having nations get together and saying, hey, what can we do collectively? You know, you might see like, you know, Singapore, Malaysia, Vietnam, these Asian nations, even bringing Japan into that, South Korea forming like these block agreements. And that might be part of why it's taking longer. And if something like that happens, then, oh shit, if you're the EU, you're like, oh damn. Oh damn. You see what I'm, this is a reality. And then global supply chains can really pressure governments. So the United States has a lot of things that we can do to make it hard on people that make it hard on us that aren't directly related to tariffs, that are little nudges that can stack up on top of this. And you do this long enough, and all you're going to do is magnify what's already happened, and that is China's now isolated. Nobody has a shittier deal than China does right now. China had the best deal there was. China got away with doing anything they wanted since the 70s when Nixon gave them most favored nation status. Now, one thing you need to know about most favored nation status, it doesn't mean you're favored over others. It's just the best deal you can get. Like, you're in a group of people who have a favored nation status, and therefore you have open trade with the United States. And Nixon did that in the 70s to peel China off of, to peel Russia off, China off Russia. Because China and Russia are really not as aligned as you think they are, but given the situation and their proximity and their unique needs that they both have, if you isolate both of them, they go together like peanut butter and jelly all of a sudden. Nixon knew if you gave China another opportunity, he could peel them off Russia and weaken that block. Today, you got Trump trying to peel Russia off China, and we'll talk more about that in a bit. As soon as this starts to happen, the United States regains more leverage than it already has a shit ton of leverage. By setting terms and drawing others into deals, America's going to reset the global trade order on its own terms. This is not a might happen. It is going to happen. The only question is how much of it will happen. Will China come along for the ride? Will they get completely isolated out? We don't know yet. Will everybody play along? Will BRICS hold together under this? Or will we successfully separate Russia from China? Or will Russia play in both worlds, the BRICS world and the U.S. world? They may be able to get away with that. This is going to reduce dependence on hostile nations. And I got to tell you something that some of you are still going to struggle with, and I've been telling you a long time. Russia is not hostile to the United States. It isn't. Russia is not trying to manipulate the United States. Russia's trying to do Russia things, and sometimes the things that are best for Russia are not things that are best for America, but they don't give a shit because when Putin says Russia first, he means it. Now, the way he goes about it, you may not be completely in love with, and neither would I be. This is not rah-rah Vladimir Putin, but he does care about his country, and he does try to do best for his country. And that actually makes him more aligned with the United States than it makes the United States aligned with the EU. The EU is heading straight into fascism, and it's not just woke. It's like uber woke. It's over the top woke. And it's locking people up for things like posting memes that are mean on social media. Russia has a lot of authoritarianism, but I ain't heard of a single person being locked up for it yet. So there's a very big chance that when this is all said and done, when the conflict in Ukraine ends, and that will be before this summer, that we're going to come out of this with a much better relationship with Russia than we have with the EU, which is going to make the EU nations, especially Germany, shit in their pants. Because if we have formed a block of deals with all of Asia other than China, and we have solid trade and relationships with Russia, they start to feel way out in the cold. And that's why some of the European Union nations are making individual deals right now as well. We also have the whole Central American, South American economy looking to play in this space as well. In other words, we could go and just do without half the countries in the world, still be fine. But very few of the countries of the world would be that well off at all if they can't sell into America, especially the larger, more developed ones. And we have a huge dependence on China for things right now that I don't understand why we're not moving faster to get away from. I mean, chipsets and stuff like that, sure, but at least we got Taiwan there, even though it's at risk. And by the way, once we build up our chip-producing capacity in the United States, I don't know if I want to be Taiwan. We may not be as good of buddies as we say we are, okay? So there's that issue, too. But in the end, this is all going to just completely begin to fall into the U.S. hegemony yet again. It's a reboot of that entire system that was developed as a world order after World War II. And then that's going to lead to what we'd call a strategic advantage compounding. Once the cascade starts, the U.S. doesn't just win one deal. It reshapes the entire playing field. It wins hundreds of deals. And whether they're as good as they seem like or not, every time one comes in, the stock market and the economy is going to rage. More and more companies are going to want to build in the United States. If you look at it right now, since Trump's taken office in 100 days, major United States corporations, and some of them are not people I'm exactly fond of, like Johnson & Johnson, I'm just saying, but, you know, some Apple, huge, Eli Lilly, like tons of these companies, good and bad, have pledged to invest money in the United States to the tune of $8 trillion. Past administrations like Obama and Bush did multi-trillion dollar or close to trillion dollar stimulus packages for the economy where they took the public's money and stole it and printed what they didn't have and just spent it into the economy. Trump effectively just pulled off an $8 trillion economic stimulus to the United States without $1 of tax money. Now, I ain't going to say it won't affect inflation because most of it's going to be borrowed, and we know that's money printing, but it's still American dollars being spent in America to build American infrastructure, American companies, and American assets. So again, I'm not wrong. This is just what's happening. If somehow Kamala Harris did all this shit, I'd be telling you, it would have never happened, but I would be telling you the same thing. Oh, but wait, there's more. I want to drive home how big the United States advantage is in this. So we're not just the biggest market in the world for imports. Okay, so export nations therefore depend on us. If you take the three biggest nations in the world other than the United States, it's China, Germany, and Japan. And if you combine Germany and China, they are actually bigger than the United States by about 20%. Okay? If you combine Japan and Germany, they're a little tiny. I mean, it's roughly equal to the U.S. in market size. So those are the only nations even worth talking about in this comparison. And it takes two of them, and none of them are well aligned from a geographic and need standpoint. The closest match would be Germany and Japan. But they can't form a block that replaces us, and neither Germany nor Japan can coexist with China for the purpose of circumventing this. They can trade with each other, sure, but they can't become the new America by combining their efforts together. It just isn't doable. And it gets worse for the rest of the world, unfortunately for them, if we look at, if we take those three nations out, you know, China, Japan, and Germany. Their next nations that we can talk about, it was six next nations, their value as importers, the United Kingdom, $900 billion, France, $800 billion, Netherlands, $780 billion, Italy, $700 billion, South Korea, $730 billion, and India, $720 billion. You have to put three of them together to get close to the United States, right? If you put UK, France, and Netherlands together, it's about $2.84 billion. The United States is like $3.1 or $3.2 billion a year. So those three nations don't add up to be one America. South Korea, India, and Italy only add up to $2.15 trillion. The United States had about $3.15 trillion. So if you put the six biggest countries other than the big four, which is us, Germany, Japan, and China, if you put the six largest countries together, they still only outpace us by about 20%. And none of these could form a consortium that makes up for our loss. On top of it, the United States has a massive amount of hard and soft power around the world, so you don't want us pissed off at you, especially if you in general enjoy a beneficial relationship to us. Countries like Canada are totally fucked. They can wag their mouth and their syrup all they want, but the Canadians are absolutely, under their current system of governance, dependent on the United States, and the United States doesn't depend on Canada at all. I'm not saying we don't get anything. We're not dependent. There's a different relationships. We benefit from a relationship. They depend on the relationship. They're totally effed. There's a 3D chess. I hate that term, but, you know, 3D or 4D chess, you know, theory that Trump actually wanted Carney elected because Canada's economy is going to go to complete dog shit, and that'll actually get maybe a chance for a real conservative government in Canada. We'll see. I still wish he would shut up about the entire 51st state thing. That's just dumb. But there's another thing in play here that no one will tell you. Because you'll hear some version of what I said on regular TV and stuff. But the other side of this is all these nations, you always hear about their free health care. They have massive social welfare programs. They're Rome, and not Rome at its height. They're Rome when every Roman citizen got all their food every day in the form of grain handed to them for free. And as soon as there was a hiccup in that, shit started burning. That, you know, the free healthcare isn't free. And the truth is a lot of our money pays for it. Our deferments of their defense in NATO, for instance, plus our fees that we pay to import items into their country, plus all the money they make exporting, all of that helps them maintain this. They have a higher baseline cost just to maintain stability, to not have their people pissed off at them. And when people are losing their jobs and losing their welfare, they get really pissed. welfare goes real quick from being something you're like, wow, I'm glad I have this, to feeling like you're entitled to it. Their governments are more politically fragile. They are more export-driven in the first place. We're trying to build an export market. They already live on one. And the U.S. just has more flexibility in a trade war. They're in a natural resource we absolutely need that we cannot produce for ourselves if we have to. And welfare states will amplify the cascade effect. Again, once one comes in, the others come in. I'd like to also add to this, and I ain't saying Trump is really smart or really stupid, but if you start looking at some of the Art of War one-liners, you start to see how they fit in here if you're not just sick with TDS. How about this? Virtuous warriors win first and then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first and then seek to win. What I'm telling you is flat out, this is done deal. We have chosen to fight a war that we already know the outcome of. Now, we may not have quite the glorious victory that's being promised, but the outcome is unquestionable. The U.S. has too much power economically and through soft political and hard political power to not win here. He will win who knows when to fight and when not to fight. This is perfectly timed. The U.S. is now on solid financial footing as it goes in the fiat world in 2025. I mean, the whole thing's a giant rug waiting to be pulled, but as it goes through the world, nobody's in better shape than us. So in war, the way to avoid what is strong... So in war, the way to avoid what is strong and strike at what is weak, okay? You want in a war, you're going to look at your enemy. Where is he strong? Where is he weak? You do not strike to his strengths. You strike to his weaknesses. And the supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting. And all warfare is based on deception. I'm going to tariff everybody. Now, except all of you guys. It's the art of the deal. It's also the art of war. And again, I'm not holding up Orange Man here as being some kind of amazing stoic genius who studied all this, though he probably did. He certainly has people working for him that did. But even if it's by happenstance, this is the way this is all going to come out. The U.S. economy's booming. I know they tell you it's not, but it's booming relative to where it was 2 years ago. That's choosing your timing. Key trading partners are economically vulnerable. China is in deep shit right now. They are stressing out. When you are a small ruling elite in a nation with over a billion people, just think of the Disney version of Ant and Grasshopper when the ants figured out how many more ants there were than grasshoppers, okay? He has legal tools like Section 301, national security clauses that shelter him and let him have this authoritarian power, and he had a political moment to act because people, like he keeps saying, this is not what people voted for. It's not what people. This is what he campaigned on. This. Anybody that says I voted for Trump, but I didn't vote for this either. You didn't pay attention at all, or you're a liar and you never voted for Trump. And remember, I didn't vote for Trump. So I'm not holding them up or protecting them here. I'm just saying this is exactly what people voted for. This is what made blue-collar union worker Democrats cross the line and vote for Trump in a way that hadn't been seen since the 1980s with the Reagan Democrats. It was this promise, two things, to do exactly economically what he's doing and close the fucking border. And that's the other thing that plays to his strength in this. The border's closed up, tighter than a monkey's butthole, glued together with super glue. So he's got political legs to stand on because you were told for how long? We need a new law. We need a new act of Congress. Joe Biden, I can't do it until I get the... I want to do it. But and then Trump just walks in and like a fucking week is done. And he's got his battles with the courts and all over deportation. But you do not have this onslaught of immigration coming in that's causing all the other problems anymore. And so he can turn his focus to this. Now, if he would just get our asses out of the freaking Middle East and quit dicking around with that and tell freaking Israel, if you want to start a war, fight your own wars, then we would be in great shape. Because I don't see Ukraine, we're going to close that down. And my other segment today was this mineral deal that we made in Ukraine. That's a huge deal, by the way, that we'll get all our money back and more that we gave those people, which most of it got pissed away by oligarchs and enriched them, and it won't take it back from them, but at least we will reboot the U.S. economically from that investment, and it's going to lead directly to, believe it or not, a stronger relationship with Russia. More on that next week. I keep saying it. It's hard to believe. I'm not 100% on it, but I'm about 80% on it. This is the first turning, not the fourth. We've had it. We've had the crisis. We had the unwinding. We had 20 fucking years of war. We had, for most of the country, not here in Texas or Florida, but for most of the country, we had 3 years of absolute, the most retarded, self-inflicted wounds on the planet with the scamdemic. We had more, I believe to this day, no one will convince me otherwise, more people died from the vaccine than the disease. Especially if you take all the people that died of COVID that would have died without COVID. When an 88-year-old person gets a respiratory infection when they're already in an end-of-life facility, they're going to die. Ask anybody that works there, they will tell you they get the cold and they die. They get pneumonia, and as Doc Bone says, they call it the old man's friend because it takes away his suffering. We've been through so much shit, and it's time to build a new high. Now, here's the thing. When you hear a new high, everybody's all nostalgic for what it must have been like after World War II from about 1955 to 1965. It doesn't mean the onslaught of statism stops. Go study the period, and were things good for the working man? Yes. But a lot of the statist bullshit that we ended up dealing with in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and forward were established during that period. So I'm not saying everything's hunky-dory, but economically, I think when Trump tells us we're going into the golden age, it's not because he believes he can do it. I think it's because he knows it's going to happen, and all you have to do to make it happen, because it is a cycle, is don't prevent it from happening. We will have to wait and see, but that's my call right now. That doesn't mean to back off of your preps, your lifestyle design, your homesteading, any of it, because it doesn't mean it's going to get better everywhere and certainly not all at the same time. And we all live at different points in our life, and just because life is good and you can go get a blue-collar job and make a decent living doesn't mean that's the way you want to live. And at the same time all this is going to get better, you're also going to see massive numbers of jobs being lost to automation and artificial intelligence. It's going to be a mixed bag. So keep working, keep prepping, never let it stop. Remember, if you want to really design your life, and I mean as a young person about to enter the workforce or go off to college, or as a little bit older person who wants to take your career and send it over to overdrive, or someone in that position who wants to get out and go into the entrepreneurial mode. If you're a young person who wants to go straight there, if you're anybody, but if you're anybody specifically in one of those modes, or you know somebody like that, my book, Laws of Life, comes out on the 12th of May, and it is designed exactly to help you do that. I really did grow up in not so great of a life. I had some good things, but a lot of bad things. And economically, it was not good. It wasn't good. When I left my home to join the military, I left with a suitcase because the Army said I needed, but that's all I had anyway. When I got out of the military and came down here to Texas, I bought a $400 car. It was a Mustang, a 1976 four-cylinder Mustang II. I bought it for $400. And everything I owned either fit in the back seat or the trunk of that car. And that's what I came to this place with. My first job was working for side money, throwing people out of a bar as a bouncer, and then packing boxes in a warehouse for $5.90 an hour. And by the time I was 26 years old, I was making a good six-figure salary. This book is how I did it. This book is how I then went on to build multiple companies. This book is how I then went on to build the Survival Podcast into a lifestyle business. These laws of life are not my laws. They are the laws I adopted in my life. They come from many sources. And the initial feedback on the people who've gotten to read the book has been exceptional. I really ask you to consider getting a copy and sending a copy to a friend. Again, May 12th, and if you don't want to forget about it, just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, scroll down till you see the book, Laws of Life. You can fill out a form there, and we will email you a couple days before launch and on the day of launch to make sure we can hit it really hard that first week. I really believe we're going to have no trouble becoming an Amazon bestseller in at least one category on that week. And so you helping me do that, I know it's a big ask, go out and spend your money on something like that, but I think it'll benefit you, and you can help us out if you'll do that. With that, I'll catch you tomorrow with a Friday flashback, and next week we'll do it all over again. Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.